You're listening to Inside Content, the TV industry podcast. This show is brought to you by 3Vision, a global TV industry consultancy specializing in content acquisition, strategy, research, and business development. Each episode, we give you VIP access to the views and experiences of senior TV executives and discuss the latest TV industry trends and insights.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's podcast. It's great to take a bit of time out of my day-to-day to stop and talk to someone about what they've been up to and some of the issues they're facing today. Today, I'm very pleased to have with me Danny Fenton, CEO and founder of Zigzag Productions. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Jack. Good to be with you.
Great. Now I'll do my own brief introduction, but I think I'll just come to you. But Danny, as I said, is CEO and founder of Zigzag. Zigzag is one of the UK's foremost independent television production companies, formed way back in 1999. I'm sorry if that makes me sound like I'm making you old, Danny, but boy, has a lot happened since 1999. I think we've maybe talk a bit about that. If I understand it correctly, you've overseen kind of the launch of offices in New York, in Manchester. You still, I think, executive produce all Zigzag content. You founded the new Independent Producers Alliance. And you can tell us more about exactly what you do. But perhaps, tell us a bit about what you do at Zigzag and your role in the company, because you'll do a better job than me.
Thanks, Jack. Yeah. As you say, I'm the founder and CEO of Zigzag. Zigzag was founded in the last century, November 1999. At that time, it wasn't particularly fashionable to launch independent production companies. And I was approached by my former boss, John Whiston from BBC Manchester, who at the time was running Yorkshire Tyne Tees Television, and asked me if I'd be interested in Yorkshire Tyne Tees backing Zigzag. Yorkshire at the time was part of Granada, as it was then, which is now obviously ITV, and regional television at the time was powerful. So Yorkshire Tyne Tees had its sort of own funds, and they took a 25% stake of the company from inception. And we were very fortunate, we hit the ground running at the time and already had sort of a lot of good relationships both in the US and in the UK. And after 2 years of Yorkshire Tyne Tees backing, we had the option to buy ourselves out of the company, and we took the opportunity to do so, and became independent, fully independent. And that remained the case until 2009, when we were approached by a then small French company called Banerjee, who I don't know whatever happened to them. I think they're still around somewhere. And we sold the company 100% in 2009. That didn't work out as we had planned, which we can come on to in more detail, but we bought the company back again in 2010, and we've remained 100% independent since 2010. Our focus has always been on unscripted programming, a split sort of 50-50 between factual and formats over the years, and we produced probably over 1,000 hours of programming in that time.
That's a lot of shows. I guess maybe I'd love to get your thoughts, if we start on the, I guess, slightly historical kind of perspective almost. Since you've launched it, I was being sort of facetious about it, but since 1999, there's been a huge amount of consumer and business change. That's even before the 2003, was it, Communication Act, which was sort of arguably one of the stimulants of the real kind of growth in the independent production sector. And since then, kind of the way consumers watch TV has just fundamentally changed. Doesn't resemble kind of now what it did 20 years ago. And with that behavioral change, we've also seen business change. We've seen gorillas like Netflix come into the market, changing the US commissioning market, or changing lots of things, more competitors, more streamers, different windows, kind of global markets opening up, I guess, different business models, direct to consumer, kind of ups and downs, I guess, of access to finance and how that changes. I mean, that's I'm now making things up, but presumably you would agree, and I'm just interested to get your perspective on how everything has changed since then, and probably since 2010 as well, when you bought back the company from Banerjee.
I mean, arguably, and sometimes it's easy to look back at things with rose-tinted glasses, those first 5 years of Zigzag were easier than the current climate. And that was even before the Communications Act sort of really kicked in. There were a lot less production companies at the time. You know, I think right now there are about 1,000 registered production companies in the UK, and I think PACT, the trade body, has over 500 plus members. And there's a lot of companies fighting over mere morsels, I would say. Whereas back then there were less companies around. But also, even before the Communications Act of 2003, people don't often talk about this, you could do a co-pro deal with Discovery or Nat Geo in the US and get them to pay 70% of the budget and then get the remaining 30% from the UK and still hold on to the rights. So there were ways of holding on to rights even before 2003. Now, obviously, 2003 was a great moment for the independent sector because it meant that the rights and IP position sort of the pendulum swung in favour of the producers. But I suppose what's happened over time is because the producers maintain the rights, the broadcasters were paying less for their rights. So you increasingly had to find co-pro money to top up the budget. So it wasn't necessarily all easy as a result of the Communications Act of 2003, but it did obviously add a lot of value to companies as a result of them owning the IP.
Yeah, I guess it's a totally different risk profile to projects sort of from that point is, I guess, what you're saying.
Yeah, so suddenly broadcasters were saying, well, if we're not going to own the rights and you're not a work for hire, then we don't want to fully fund your project. So that actually saw a growth in the co-production market, probably a growth in the distribution market as a result of it as well, because distributors became more significant in trying to plug the gaps on budgets.
And you mentioned, it's interesting, because you talked about before kind of the Comms Act and the working in global markets. You've talked about global markets and you mentioned our mutual friends at PACT, actually, who we work with on the export report. I think if we stay in the kind of broader sense of it, and not maybe yet discuss the headwinds facing many businesses at the moment globally, but global is important to you. I mean, from what you've said, and you in particular the US, but generally the global market for you has been that way for a while.
Yeah, because I've always felt that UK producers are very well regarded and held in high esteem internationally. I think the sort of client mark of British production is probably perceived as being the best in the world. And therefore, in a UK market, which is actually relatively small in the great scheme of things, because even though we may have like 1,000 channels on a EPG, on a Sky EPG, there's only really half a dozen main buyers in the UK putting the streamers to one side. And therefore, the world of television is more significant. So even from our early days when we were part of Yorkshire Timetees and we worked with Granada International, we started to do Canadian co-productions because there were tax incentives to work with Canada. We were already sort of moving into the US, sort of the bridgehead into the US for a lot of UK companies. At that time was Discovery and National Geographic in Washington, as it was at the time. And then increasingly over the years, we've always remained open-minded that our market is the world, and because British producers are so well received, you can take your project anywhere.
And the focus, I mean, it's interesting you talked about the bridge being kind of Discovery-like, kind of but with the kind of growth in services and the growth in kind of people out there offering content, that means that your global view isn't particularly narrow. So even in the US and other markets, kind of you feel kind of the kite mark of UK content works for quite a wide variety of people.
I think we're fortunate in that we speak the same language as the Americans, and therefore UK-produced content has always done well in the US, and increasingly more and more British producers have had success in selling into the US. For us, we opened up the US office in, I think, 2005, and the US has been up to 50% of our turnover at points because the budgets are bigger. And going back to what I said about there being only a handful of buyers in the UK, I mean, the last time I counted in the US for Unscripted, there were 71 different buyers. So there's a lot more opportunity to sell in the US because there are a lot more buyers. Putting current market conditions to one side, historically there have always been, you know, more opportunities in the US than the UK. And I think, you know, a lot of UK producers have tried to capitalise on that.
So I think, not wishing to move on to gloomier kind of subjects, but obviously the current market is challenged. I mean, we saw good, well, there's lots of ways you can look at it. Just on the global UK export front, kind of great year, financial year that ended 2023. Kind of numbers were up kind of everywhere, really. And the highest kind of number that I think that since the reports have been done. But everyone kind of within that on a qualitative basis recognized that kind of there are headwinds and the coming year is going to be a challenge. And we know from kind of the very public narrative in that commentators have, and also from what some company reports are saying, that kind of it's been a tough year, particularly in the US, which, if as you've said, is such a big part of the market. And it's not just about the US studios, who have had a big strategic refocus. They've kind of obviously invested a lot in D2C. Now they're focused, got a lens a bit more towards profitability. They've been cutting their costs, and everyone has been trimming their content spend in the US. Also, the streaming service has been focused on profitability. Kind of the linear TV networks have had a tough time because the advertising market's been hit hard, and also their audience is fragmenting. Pay TV is losing subscribers. So generally, US market's been really tough. And we've seen kind of people love talking about the end of peak TV. I guess from your perspective, you've seen this, you've seen this, you feel this because you're working with people, no doubt, who are facing those pressures.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think in 2008, when there was a recession, it wasn't as bad as this current market for TV producers or content providers as we are now. The way I like to describe it is, before the pandemic, I think if there was a seesaw, everybody imagined that the sort of streaming money would go up and the linear money would go down on the seesaw. A weird byproduct of the pandemic is that obviously a lot of money wasn't spent during that period because production wasn't possible. So when we came out of the pandemic, we saw this sort of U-shape on the seesaw where streaming money and linear money both went up at the same time because there was a lot of spending. But it was a sort of a false economy, and it wasn't a sort of real reflection of where the market was. And what we've now seen in the last 18 months, I'd say, is both sides of the seesaw coming down at the same time. So, you know, because of ad revenue downturn, I think in the UK specifically, because of the war in Europe, because of the war in the Middle East, because of Brexit, which doesn't sort of get talked about a lot. We've had a sort of perfect storm of everything that could go wrong has gone wrong. And Channel 4 obviously being a good sort of bellwether, that Channel 4 is the biggest commissioner of independent content in the UK because they're a publisher broadcaster, well, they certainly were until recently. And they've really not been commissioning anything, and they keep pushing it down the road in terms of when they're going to be able to commission again. So I think, you know, we are in somewhat of an omni crisis in the production community. And as I say, for most UK producers, the US has been sort of a haven when the UK market has been suffering. But the US market has been even worse than the UK market recently.
Yeah, and I think you kind of, I couldn't agree more when I think you described it as a perfect storm. I think it's just that confluence of factors. The US had, on top of that, they had the strikes, which kind of, in some respects, I think a lot of the studios used as an opportunity to kind of reset and to clear things up. So that as well. I don't think there's not one thing you need to attribute to. There's multiple in the US plus multiple in the UK. And, I mean, I guess it's not green shoots. The thing that when we talk to people, kind of the one thing that it comes back to is it is still an incredibly competitive ecosystem for the video services, to use the broader sense of the term. And hopefully kind of that will be the kind of the underlying factor that will get us back somewhere better than, you know, get us back into, well, I was going to say back into growth, but get back into somewhere that kind of is a prettier picture than we have now.
Yeah, look, I think the production universe has changed forever. I don't think it will go back to what it was previously. I don't like this phrase that's been used, survive till 25, because we're only in, you know, March now, and there's a long time to go for the rest of the year. I think you're right though, Jack, that what we have to remember as producers is that we're content providers, and whether that be on tablets, on telephones, on aeroplanes, on taxis, on in urinals, you know, wherever there are screens, they need content. So I think we just have to pivot to where the content is. And I'm sure we'll sort of get into this more, but I think that whole direct to consumer conversation and, you know, the growth of fast channels is an area of hope.
Yeah. And even for, I mean, obviously for, I think the problem with a lot of the direct to consumer kind of discussions that have been going on over the last 12 months is, so it was almost framed in a kind of all or nothing debate that the studios might or might not have, and which is kind of ultimately wrong, because it's never an all or nothing thing. It maybe was for Disney, almost, not quite, but for the others, they were always playing it in other markets, and for them it's a balance. But for you, even for you as a compared to that relatively smaller speaking player, kind of how do you view the D2C market? Have you seen opportunities there as well?
Look, I think one advantage we have as a 100% independent company with a 25-year back catalogue is that we are in a unique position where we've got a library we can exploit. And whether that be with fast channels, and we actually just recently launched a YouTube channel with the help of Little Dot, that is a Zigzag channel. So I think there are opportunities to exploit, you know, back catalogue and our content and build a direct-to-consumer relationship that way. You know, we've also launched our own sports channel in China as a joint venture, which we started before the pandemic and is now getting, you know, up to 14 million views a week. And there's also the ability to do sort of transactional deals on that platform as well. So I think there are ways to go D2C, but it's obviously not easy for everybody to sort of pivot in that way.
Yeah, I guess that's the kind of key question. I mean, perhaps I'm completely speculating it, but in a way, kind of, you have, because of your DNA, you're quite you appear to be a company that's quite innovative. You kind of look for opportunities. Probably quite nimble. Your size means that you're able to be quite nimble and spot these opportunities and work with them, I guess. But does that, to me, it means that has to be part of the culture of a business which they have to develop if they don't have it, to be able to think a little bit more. It's not just strategically, but just think a bit more about kind of how you can do things with your content rather than just look for the next sale to the next person.
I think we've been entrepreneurial out of necessity, because as the commissioning market has sort of dried up in recent months, then we have to look at other ways of exploiting our content, and a lot of that is using our, you know, back catalogue. I'd say in some ways the so-called super indies are more Facebook to do that because they've got the infrastructure to do that. Whereas if you're a small to medium sized independent, your focus is predominantly on keeping the lights on and keeping the train on the track. So, everybody would like to be entrepreneurial. The problem with, let's say, the fast channel universe is it's more jammed tomorrow. And there aren't many, if any, fast channels that are paying minimum guarantees or advances on content. So you're having to take a gamble in a way by delivering all the content, which is at a cost, in the hope that you've backed the right fast channels that are going to get you a return.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it's in one of those awkward stages fast where it's consuming a lot of oxygen and there's a lot of hype around it, and there's a lot of good revenue in the US for a lot of people, and there's some revenue elsewhere, but it's still at a very low level and it's still very challenging. But it's really exciting and it's a kind of opportunity, but it's one having to navigate. You have to navigate it, definitely. Okay, that's brilliant. I mean, we're coming close to time, but I kind of have to ask you about one of the other themes of the year, which is probably less directly commercially rated, but that is the phenomenon and the buzz around AI, more specifically, I guess, generative AI, with kind of, I guess, it was a sector where investors piled in billions in 2023. So you've got to pay attention to it. And it's not a new thing. It's just someone polished up ChatGPT, put a UI in it and got a few more people interested is my view. But, and it's not easy to sort of talk about because, and the kind of, I almost feel kind of, well, it's been, portrayed kind of almost universally in films as destructive, with the exception of a few films. And there's sort of almost three camps, I feel. There's Bill Gates, who's very vocal on it and recognizes the strengths that it can offer businesses, that it can take huge workloads and processes do it for him. There's kind of creatives. I'm thinking of the ones more like Nick Cave, who kind of talk about it not being able to feel or have emotion and think, and therefore all that comes out is soulless rubbish. And then there's kind of those in between who kind of actually might have been using it already. There's plenty of tools already that have been used for it. And I just interested, I mean, it became a point of contention as part of the strikes, which I think was kind of made up during the process. It was never really part of the issue at the start. From your point of view, I guess perhaps more practically, kind of, have you got thoughts on where that sits in it with your business?
I mean, I always see myself as a little bit of a technophobe and not sort of fully up to speed on the latest sort of technological opportunities. I went to a conference run by PACT on AI, and I came back with all this information to the office to say, oh my God, did you know you could do this and that with AI or whatever? And my colleague said to me, but we're already doing all of that already. So things like subtitling or translation, there are AI-based apps that do a lot of the things in TV that we take for granted. And I think the big thing that people say is that not that AI is going to replace people's jobs. It's people using AI that will replace people's jobs. And I think that there are clearly opportunities with AI to take away some of the mundanity of the jobs in TV, like logging, I think in the animation, not needing to rotoscope anymore. So I think there are a lot of positives that come out of AI that will improve the process. I think John McVeigh at PACT said it will give a boon to sales of shows internationally because you won't need to have everything translated. You'll automatically be able to sell shows with the dubbing done through AI per territory. So I can see there will be a lot of positives that will come out of AI. But I think because I'm, as a bit of a technophobe and a late adopter, I feel like they're going to happen by osmosis. Like I'm not going out there trying to sort of find out what the next AI invention is going to be. I just think it's happening. It's already happening, and we may not realize it. Like you said, you know, I think we've been using AI without even realizing we're using it.
Yeah, I think absolutely right. I think just the same way my life has become easier by adopting various pieces of software and technology and things like that, I think you're right. I think that's going to happen more and more. I can't remember who it was. Someone cleverer than me said, think of it as having infinite interns, which is kind of a good way of thinking of it, because it basically is you only get anything good out if you put something in and you need to check it all. So, which I thought was quite a good way of putting it. But look, Danny, that's great.
I mean, one of the only negatives, sorry, on the AI side is that it's a little bit like the Wild West. So, you know, when you talk about the generative AIs, whether people are actually taking IP of, you know, that they don't own as a way of generating content. So I think that there's going to need to be some sort of rules and restrictions around the use of AI. But I mean, I think generally speaking, it should be a force for good for the industry.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Look, Danny, thanks so much for your time. As always, it's great to talk. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Inside Content, the TV industry podcast brought to you by 3Vision. With decades of TV industry experience and real-world success, we know the ins and outs of the market like nobody else. To learn more about our TV consultancy services, head to 3vision.tv.